A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host for this journey into issues facing the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues these organizations are facing. Today, we'll get a sense of what goes into creating a new ballet based on a well-known classic novel. The American Repertory Ballet will premiere its full-length adaptation of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice later this month, and I'll speak with artistic director Douglas Martin about how he approached the choreography and selected the music, primarily from works by Ignaz Pleyel. I'll also chat with Taras Pavlovsky, Dean of the Library at the College of New Jersey, who assisted with locating the scores which Martin adapted for the ballet. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. The opera world gasped and then heaved a sigh of relief after conflicting reports about soprano Renee Fleming's career plans following her performance this May as the Marceline in the Metropolitan Opera's production of Der Rosenkavalier. The New York Times said the performance may be Fleming's farewell to staged opera. The article cited an interview with Fleming in which she said she was looking ahead to doing more concert performances and recordings and devoting additional time to her role as creative consultant at the Lyric Opera of Chicago. Those may be some of her options, but soon after, another report pointed out that the operative word was may. In a subsequent interview with NPR, Fleming said while she plans to step away from some of her best-known roles, such as Marceline and the lead in Dvorak's Rusalka, she is not exiting the opera stage just yet. She has performances at the Met scheduled in 2019 and told NPR that she is also looking at new operas and productions. How good have the arts been for our civilization? A University of Pennsylvania researcher will delve into that question, examining the benefits of the arts and humanities on society and its well-being. According to UPenn, James Pavelski, Director of Education and Senior Scholar at its Positive Psychology Center, received a $2.5 million grant to explore the impact of music, literature, and other aspects of the arts on civilization and socialization. The research will include interdisciplinary forums and an opportunity to share its results with major arts institutions. Most performing arts organizations request that mobile devices be turned off during performances, but at a recent Pennsylvania ballet production, some of the orchestra musicians were forced to play by the light of their phones after their stand lights went on the fritz. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, once the lights began to flicker, the musicians either turned to the flashlight feature on their phones or continued to play in the dark. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. Jane Austen's works continue to enthrall the public, and in recent years, stage and film adaptations have multiplied. But while there have been feature films and TV adaptations, new books based on Austen's themes and characters, and some operatic treatments, there have been few recent efforts to bring it to the ballet stage. But this month, Elizabeth, Mr. Darcy, and other key figures in Pride and Prejudice will take center stage in the world premiere of American Repertory Ballet's Pride and Prejudice, created by artistic director Douglas Martin. In creating the score, which will be performed by the Princeton Symphony Orchestra in its MacArthur Theater debut, Martin turned primarily to the music of Ignaz Pleyel, an endeavor that required quite a bit of legwork to track down printed versions of some of the works. I spoke with Martin about where he found the inspiration for the ballet and what drew him in particular to the music of Pleyel.
I'm always looking for material for a full-length ballet, and while there are a lot of wonderful full-length ballets out there, you know, there are a lot of fairy tales. There are a few things like Romeo and Juliet and Midsummer Night's Dream and a few other productions that aren't fairy tales. There aren't really that many, to be honest, that are right, especially for a smaller company like ours. We have 16 professional dancers. We have some trainees who are able to fill out some of the core roles. But realistically, you know, it's a little bit smaller than a, you know, 50-member cast of, say, Swan Lake or something like that. So the numbers and the choreography have to work out. So I'm always looking for new material, and I've always loved Jane Austen, and I thought, well, what about Pride and Prejudice? So I started investigating what a ballet could be with this material. The natural idea is that you have two leads with Darcy and Elizabeth. But the truth is, this ballet really has eight leads. You have four couples that get together by the end of the book, and they're all fodder for the propulsion of the story. And everything that happens to all of them propel Elizabeth and Darcy together in the end. So I thought, actually, once I understood that I really felt like it could be fleshed out into a ballet.
So now, how did you go about then the actual kind of the mechanics of figuring out what you wanted to include in the ballet and how you translated that into the action on stage?
It's funny because pretty much the last element of this ballet is the action on stage. I only started choreographing 9 weeks ago, but I've been working on the libretto and then the score for the past 3 years. So the first thing that happens is that you have to go chapter by chapter and really understand what propels the narrative and what's important to tell and what's just color. And then even the color is important, but at the same time, you know, it's usually told in 6 hours. You know, I certainly cannot do a 6-hour long ballet. So I have to look at how I can get the important propulsion elements of the story in while still keeping it within, you know, 2 and 2.5 hour length. So I worked on that for a while. And then the next most important thing is dance is a language of visual elements and emotion. You know, this is great dialogue. This book has phenomenal dialogue. And I'm thinking, okay, what do we do in ballet to express all this fabulous dialogue? Well, we express it by expressing the emotions. And so when you're watching dance, what is really important is that the music helps you express those emotions. So I've always loved Schubert, and initially I was going to do the entire ballet to a Schubert score, but then upon further research, I found out that Jane Austen really loved a great composer of the day named Itzhak Pleyel, and he's a student of Haydn, and he was a superstar in London because of the Napoleonic conflict. A lot of those European composers came to London, and he was superstar. I mean, literally, some of the most favored music of the day. And so I thought, well, that would be interesting. I've never heard of him. Let's investigate that. And as I started to listen to his music, I started actually feeling like Jane Austen was listening to that music as she wrote the story. It really started to tell me the story through the expression of that music. And so instantly grabbed on his music, and for one reason or another, either we couldn't find all of the score because a lot of it has not been published to all the music I found. We incorporated some other composers of that era, from Mendelssohn to Schubert to John Field, so that we could round out the score. And then what I had to do is create a score that expressed the narrative. So that took about a year to really flesh out the entire story and how I was going to tell it through the music, cutting the music down, putting it in certain places. And once I did that, the ballet was actually in place.
Now let's talk a bit about that search for the Pleyel scores. I understand it took quite a bit of detective work to get the ones that you were able to get. Who did you turn to, and how did that help you reach your goal?
Well, we're a small organization, and I do have a number of friends in high places, but the truth is that a lot of Pleyel's music, he had a piano company, and he also had a publishing company. But for some reason, although he published his own music 200 years ago, like anyone, a lot of great composers' music has been lost through time, because it was all about people finding the music, being able to pass it on. It's not like today we could just go online and order the music. And so it was all about new music coming along and what's being played during the time. There was a big shift from classical music to romantic music. And so I'm sure that a lot of the classic music has been forgotten simply because the romantic music came along and the romantic era, and so people were more excited about that. So it turned out that even though I had digital copies of a lot of his music, most of the music was published by or created by these orchestras, as opposed to a publishing company that professionally produced it for sale. So I'm hearing all this digital music, and we go online, and we can't find any of it anywhere because it hasn't actually been published, even though it's been recreated. So we had to contact orchestras. We had to contact libraries around the world who might have a copy of this or that. I have a friend who works at the College of New Jersey at the library, and he was able to find newer versions of these. But in the end, what we had to do is take virtually all of the music, and one of my music specialists was able to add it all by hand into a computer program and make the cuts, make the updates. And so in the end, we ended up having to create the entire score for ourselves, which would be normal for a big orchestra. They have lots of people, librarians and other people. For us, it was really detective work and then just hard physical work to get it into a computer and create a new version.
Well, and that score will be performed by the Princeton Symphony Orchestra. How often do you have the chance to work with them?
About 17 years ago, they played a couple pieces for a performance that we did under that director, Graham Lustig. They did a piece of Herman, and I can't remember who the other piece that they did. It was just two pianos. But we have worked together before, but only once and many, many years ago. Under my tenure, the other two full lengths outside of Nutcracker, we've also done with a live orchestra, Romeo and Juliet and Midsummer Night's Dream, for the premiere. So I'm used to trying to do this, but to get a professional orchestra in is always a challenge. It's a cost challenge, and it's also just making sure you have all of the elements together. And this is a completely original score. So, you know, making sure the conductor's score, making sure the parts are all there, it's just a huge labor of love, really. But to have a live orchestra of the caliber of Princeton Symphony Orchestra is amazing. It's an amazing experience for the audience. Dance should be performed to live music. The energy you get from an orchestra is really something you can't reproduce with canned music. At the same time, dance is really the struggling low man on the totem pole when you consider arts funding. And so to come up with the music, most companies just can't do it. You even see major companies now performing less with live music because it's expensive. And realistically, arts funding is way down.
I was wondering if you could kind of elaborate a little bit on that as far as the energy that this live music brings. What is that like to have the dynamic with the orchestra in the pit and then the dancers on stage? How does that all really come together?
It's quite a miraculous transformation. The dancers are rehearsing to a canned score, and they learn the music off of those tempos and the pause lengths and all the different things that we do. And it's this fabulous experience for them to get acquainted to the music. But when you rehearse many, many weeks in a row to recorded music, you start becoming accustomed to the actual tempo of the rhythm of that music. What happens when an orchestra steps in is, first of all, you start hearing different instruments because depending on the makeup of the orchestra and what you have recorded, it's going to sound different. Some of the music I have is recorded by symphonies, some chamber orchestras. We're going to have a 22-piece chamber orchestra, so I'm sure that the greater amount of the music is going to sound different to this company. Then the dancers are responding to the different tempos of live music, no matter how hard the orchestra tries to maintain a certain tempo that we're used to. It's live. And what I always find, the most wonderful thing for me as a choreographer and as a director watching the company, is I see them dancing with their ears open. I see them responding to live music. And no matter how well they dance and how musical they dance to a recorded score, there is a certain amount of repetition to that they become accustomed to, as opposed to reactionary. And it's a wonderful experience. It's an experience of seeing the energy of on stage and feeling the energy of performers from the pit. So I don't think you can compare it at all. It's just really unique.
Well, I want to turn back to the score for a minute. How would you describe the parts and the excerpts that you were able to bring together? What feel does the music have?
In the end, it's quite interesting. The Pleyel music, he's a classical composer from the latter part of the 18th century through early part of the 19th century. And so you get these interesting things that classical music gives you, kind of an A, B, C, B, A type of repetition through. But what I loved about Pleyel is he reminded me very much of Mendelssohn in the way that his music tends to be narrative. As I'm listening to the score initially, I start seeing Jane Austen's train of thought played out. Even though he didn't write the music for her, I know that she was listening to this music at the time. And I can actually see, just like Mendelssohn did with, say, Midsummer Night's Dream, you start to see characters described in the music, in the repetition and the repeating of different sections. Then you can start saying, ah, that's Mr. Bennett, and that's when he reappears here. It starts telling you how the characters will dance and reappear, and it starts describing them. And I can't say that about all the classical era musicians. Some are very narrative, like Mendelssohn, and they tell stories within their melodies, and others have a more mathematical sense. I hate to compare anyone, but when I listen to Beethoven, I hear that strength in the mathematical composition of his, whereas Mendelssohn, I really hear this narrative, and I do the same with Pleyel. The pieces I chose from Mendelssohn and from Schubert are all very narrative as well. The other thing that I did with the Schubert is I realized later on when the second act starts to break, the story starts to break into smaller relationships, smaller groups having relationships. So the first act is whole towns getting to know each other, and then people start to break into, you know, groups of four, two, potatoes types of things like that. And I have a number of cello and piano pieces that then I'm using to describe the relationships through the instruments. When Darcy proposes to Elizabeth and she refuses him, we have a great Schubert work, and it's the cello and piano. The cello's angry and kind of screeching and complaining, and the piano is softer and prettier, but at the same time accelerates through it. So I'm using Elizabeth as the piano and Darcy as the cello through that to help explain what they're emotionally going through. Also, the music tends to go from earlier music in the first act through the end of the ballet as the characters mature and as time moves on. It ends in the romantic era with Schubert and Mendelssohn. And so it's kind of fun to see the progression of music through time as well as the characters moving through that time.
Now, of course, Jane Austen has quite a very loyal following. Do you feel that you'll be able to tap into a new pool of potential ballet goers?
That is a hope with this particular ballet. We're always looking for new audiences and getting people to understand, you know, dance through movement, but also dance is a language. Everybody dances, whether they gesticulate or, you know, you can just see people reacting when they're speaking. They double up with movements of their body because that's just what we do as animals. You can see birds do it. You see bugs do it. It's a way of communicating. And so when people start to understand their relationship to dance, you know, people say, oh, I don't really dance. I don't go see dance. It's like saying, I don't speak that language when we all do. And so the education of children and people in that language of dance and how we're all using it, and then to get a greater education of why classical dance is important. It's the high language of dance. And so the more you see it, the more you understand how it tells us what our culture is and who we are, the more you understand about yourself. So it's not just the Jane Austen story. It's actually the story of the language of dance. But I'm hoping to get people to experience that because they love Jane Austen and will come see this ballet.
Well, you touched on the funding challenge and also the fact that dance sometimes has a harder larger hill to climb in terms of that, but also in terms of attracting audiences. How have you found over the last few years, what have you been finding that really works to tap in and bring new people in and expand and diversify the types of people that come and sit in the audience?
we've known this for a while, that to introduce people to dance, the narrative is usually the better introduction. So people want to come see, you know, the Nutcracker, and they'll tell me afterwards, oh, I don't go to ballet. You know, I'll go see the Nutcracker. Is that ballet? They don't actually even think of it as a ballet because it has such a strong story in it that they can follow. Hmm. And so as an educational tool to get people to understand dance, these narrative ballets, these story ballets, are the inroad. And you can go to New York and see that the story ballets sell better than the repertoire. And that's just a universal truth, because you can attract a larger audience because they don't have to have a greater appreciation for dance when they see a very new contemporary work. Probably the same for opera, right? We'll go in and it's much harder to see the Rake's Progress than it is La Boheme. So I think that the introduction of dance on the whole, whether it's children or adults, is easier with the narrative. And then once they realize that they do love it and they love the experience of seeing the movement to music and the expression, and they get more educated in it, then they'll want to come and see these wonderful repertory shows where it is dance for dance sake, and the energy and the movement and the style of the company can come to the forefront.
That was Douglas Martin, Artistic Director of the American Repertory Ballet, which will premiere Martin's full-length ballet, Pride and Prejudice, later this month. As Martin mentioned, it took some detective work to locate all the music that he wanted to use for the final score. After finding recordings of appropriate works, the next task was to find printed editions of the music so that they could be worked together into the score that the orchestra will perform. The task of tracking down the music fell to Taras Pavlovsky, Dean of the Library at the College of New Jersey. I asked him to walk us through some of the steps he went through to identify and locate the printed music to match what Martin had requested.
It took mostly tools that are stock in trade for a music librarian. I'm no longer a practicing music librarian, but I was. Music librarians may or may not have musicology backgrounds. You know, they may be some kind of musicians. I do have graduate degrees in musicology, also in librarianship, specializing in music librarianship. So the first part, anyway, of what I did was fairly stock in trade for a music librarian. Music titles can be horribly deceiving. And the fact that you can find a piece of music recorded on the internet, on a YouTube or something, in no way proves that there must be an edition out there. Well, no, not at all. People play from museum copies or handwritten copies or unpublished materials all the time. So there was a couple of different steps. The first step was verifying and, when necessary, correcting the title information that I got from Douglas from his YouTube clips. So when I came on, there were 39 cuts. I'm not quite sure how many he ended up with, somewhere in that area, I guess. Roughly two-thirds, I'm going from memory here, I'm sure he gave you the whole breakdown, were Play L. There was some Schubert, there was some Mendelssohn, and there was some John Field. So the first step was essentially just going through with a thematic catalog and seeing, okay, this is what your YouTube poster called this piece. Guess what? There is no such piece in the Play L thematic catalog. So what could it be? Well, if his cut was at the beginning of a piece, that was easier because the thematic catalog gives you the incipit, the first four bars or whatever. But a lot of his cuts weren't. They were internal, so it was trial and error work, digging around. Find the beginning of any given piece and see if it and match it, the title of it up that way. It's more time consuming. So that was the first step, was identifying and correcting and identifying which movement. And so in some cases, I'm going from memory here, I think maybe in three or four, they actually had the wrong title or incomplete title or a wrong key. Play L, he wasn't Handel, but he republished a lot of his own work under different keys and, you know, with different arrangements for this instrument or that instrument. So, you know, the one particularly memorable one is they had Douglas had a recording of a concerto in B flat for clarinet, and that was actually going to be a problem because the Princeton Chamber Symphony wasn't bringing a clarinet because it was playing also a little early for clarinets, right? And then, well, hello, the clarinet was a much later version. The original piece was in C, and it was for cello. So it all worked out very well. So that was the first part, was identifying them. And the second part was trying to find scores, because, again, if you're a choreographer putting together music For a canned performance, that's pretty much all you need is the recording, and then you manipulate it using whatever software you use to manipulate, cut out your leading and trailing pauses, what have you, and make up whatever cuts you need. But if you're going to get an orchestra to play that, you actually have to find the printed music, and then you have to find the place in the music that corresponds to your cut, and then when you're actually making cuts, says go from this measure to that measure, you have to make those cuts so the musicians can actually follow. So that was the second part, using, again, tools of a music librarian that are stock and trade for a music librarian to, first of all, ascertain the existence of printed editions of this work, and then requesting them through interlibrary loan. And then the third part was listening to, with the score, once the score has come in, listening to the score, you know, with your headphones on, and listening to Doug's cut, and no, that's not it, and find, yeah, if it starts at the top of the piece, that's great, but that was rarely the case. So it was a matter of, you know, following along, and then, whoops, that's not what's here, so, you know, well, you get the idea.
Hmm.
Playing it over and over and over and flipping pages, you know, until, oh, that's it. Okay, so he's jumping from, you know, this cadence here in the middle of measure 73 to the middle of measure 192. So identifying stuff, identifying those cuts, some cases actually rewriting cadences, classical era play all music. It likes modulations to go in the right direction. So we did that a couple of times, just, you know, reworking a couple notes, just so the cut that Douglas had in his head to fit the choreography made sense and was not so abrasive to the musical perception.
Well, I was speaking with Douglas, he mentioned that he chose it because, in part, because of the contemporary sense that this is something that might have been playing, that Jane Austen might have been listening
mm-hmm.
to. So,
yeah.
from your perspective, how would you describe Pleyel and where he sat in kind of the classical genre?
I think Pleyel was, this is just my opinion, early in his career, he had some inventive use, especially some good melodic writing. His harmonies are very middle of the road classical stuff. But he, even melodically speaking, I think he kind of burned himself out. The second half of his career was pretty unremarkable, I suspect. I mean, it's all finely crafted, but it's not. There's a reason that more people know Mozart's name than know Pleyel's, right? You know, it was salon music, parlor music, and in that, she may well have heard it.
That was Taras Pavlovsky, Dean of the Library at the College of New Jersey. Pride and Prejudice will be performed April 21st and 22nd at MacArthur Theater in Princeton. You can find more information about the production at arballet.org. I hope you appreciate the conversations I bring you each week on A Tempo and all of the other high-quality programs of the award-winning Classical Network. Remember, these programs are possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for joining me for A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. An archive of recent shows can be found anytime at our webcast page at wwfm.org. Join me next week for another look at the changing world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is supported by the listener members of the Classical Network.